rain fell over St. Aldwyn's churchyard in thin grey sheets, the kind that soaked through wool and left every hem heavy with mud. Louisa Kensington stood alone at the church door, already humiliated once by the man who had jilted her at the altar for her own half-sister, now waiting on a second groom she had never even met, arranged in haste by a stepmother, desperate to bury the scandal before it buried her instead. Then came the sound of wheels, slow and groaning, dragging through the mud at the end of the lane. The carriage that appeared was not fit for a wedding. It was not fit for anything. Warped wood, paint long peeled away, wheels caked thick with brown filth, a horse too tired to lift its head. The crowd under their umbrellas did not even wait for the door to open before the laughter started. No one in that churchyard, not the guests pointing and snickering, not the bride bracing herself for one more public shame, not even the stepmother who had arranged this match purely to be rid of her, had the slightest idea what stepped down out of that mud. They believed they were watching a desperate woman settle for a pauper. They were, in truth, about to watch the richest duke in all of England walk toward a wedding, wearing the only thing he had ever wanted people to see. Nothing but the man underneath. But that truth was still locked behind a door none of them would open for months. For now, all the churchyard saw was mud, and a wreck of a carriage, and a bride they were already certain they understood. They were wrong about almost everything, and the cost of that mistake would follow every one of them long after the laughter finally stopped. Greetings, dear viewers. Your support has brought this channel farther than I ever imagined, and we are so grateful. If you enjoy these tales of old Victorian England, do well to subscribe, leave a like, tell us where in the world you are listening from, the time and the day, and support us in ways that you can. Thank you so much. Now then, let us go back to our story. England, 1878. Louisa Kensington stood at the church door in a gown that had once belonged to her mother, listening to the murmurs of guests who had not come to see her married. They had come to see her shamed. She was 22 years old, the only daughter of the late Earl of Kensington, and for most of her life she had stood half a step behind her beautiful half-sister Vivian, watching rooms light up for someone else. Louisa was not unlovely. She had her father's steady, grey-green eyes, and a quiet, watchful grace that no one in her family had ever thought to notice. But Vivian was golden-haired, and laughing, and impossible to look away from. And in a house where attention was the only currency that mattered, Louisa had always come up poor. 3 weeks earlier, she had believed her life was finally turning toward the light. She had been engaged to Lord William Prescott, a baronet's son with a pleasant face and ambitions far larger than his fortune. She had not loved him with any great fire, but she had been grateful, and gratitude, she told herself, was its own kind of safety. Then William stood before all of London society at the Hartwell Ball and announced, with Vivian's hand already resting on his arm, that he would not be marrying Louisa Kensington after all. He would be marrying her sister. The room had gone silent, the way a held breath goes silent. Louisa remembered the heat that crawled up her neck, the way her own glass of champagne had trembled in her hand, the way every face in that ballroom had turned to drink in her humiliation, like wine. She remembered Vivian's small, satisfied smile, the smile of a woman who had simply taken what she wanted because she had always been allowed to. In Victorian society, a woman publicly rejected does not merely lose a husband. She loses her place in the world. Invitations stop arriving. Mothers steer their sons elsewhere. Doors that were once open swing quietly shut, and no one ever says why, because everyone already knows. Lady Caroline Kensington, Louisa's stepmother, had not wasted a single day on sympathy. Within a week, she was hunting for any solution that would remove the scandal from her household before it could spread further. Like a stain, she was desperate to scrub from a white tablecloth. Louisa had heard her stepmother through the drawing-room door, speaking in low, urgent tones to a solicitor about arrangements, about a match that could be made, quickly and quietly, about a man named Ashcroft, who needed a wife and asked no questions. Louisa had not protested. What was there left to protect? Her reputation was already ash. So when she was told a Mr. Sebastian Ashcroft, a country gentleman of modest means, had agreed to marry her within the month, she had only nodded and gone to choose a gown that would not remind her of the one she had meant to wear for William. Now she stood in the church doorway, rain misting against her veil, and watched the road for a carriage that did not come. The guests waited under black umbrellas, murmuring. Vivian sat near the front pew in deep wine-red silk, radiant, watching Louisa's discomfort with poorly hidden delight. Lady Caroline's mouth was a tight line. The minutes stretched, then came the sound, a rattling, groaning creak of old wood and tired wheels rising over the patter of rain. Heads turned toward the lane. A carriage rolled into view, dragging itself toward the church as though it might give up the journey entirely before it arrived. Its boards had gone soft and dark with rot in places, its iron fittings rusted orange, and the poor bay drawing it stumbled once in the mud before catching itself, head hanging low under the rain. A ripple of laughter broke out before the carriage had even fully stopped. "Good heavens!" someone called from beneath an umbrella, not troubling to lower his voice. "Has the groom borrowed a farmer's wagon?" More laughter followed, sharp and delighted, the kind of cruelty that wealthy people allow themselves when they believe no consequence will ever find them. Vivian pressed a gloved hand to her mouth, her eyes bright with amusement. Even Lady Caroline, for all her desperation to see this marriage through, flinched at the sight of the thing rattling up the church path. The door of the carriage opened, and a man stepped down into the mud without hesitation, without flinching at the muck soaking instantly into his boots. He was tall, broad through the shoulders, in a way his plain dark coat could not quite disguise, with a strong, weathered jaw and eyes the color of slate under a heavy gray sky. He did not look at the laughing crowd. He looked, first and only, toward the church door, toward Louisa. There was something in the way he moved, unhurried, unbothered, that did not match the poverty of his carriage at all. Louisa felt it before she understood it, a quiet, settled confidence, the kind that wealth alone cannot buy, and poverty cannot quite explain away. But the crowd was too busy laughing at his wheels to notice the man standing in them. "They have sent her a man who travels like a tinker," Vivian murmured to her companion, just loud enough to carry. More laughter rippled through the umbrellas. Louisa felt every eye in the churchyard slide toward her, gleaming with the particular pleasure people take in watching another's fall continue. She had already lost her fiancé in front of all of London. Now it seemed she would marry a pauper in front of the same crowd and give them a fresh story to tell over their tea. For one long moment, she considered turning back into the church, refusing, letting the scandal swallow her whole, rather than stand beside this final humiliation. She had spent her whole life being the one who was overlooked, the one who was laughed at, quietly behind fans and loudly behind closed doors. She could feel the old familiar shame rising in her chest like flood water. Then she looked again at the man standing in the mud. He was watching her. Not the crowd, not their laughter. Only her, with an expression she could not name. Not pity. Not amusement. Something steadier than either. Something that looked strangely like respect. Louisa lifted her chin. She walked down the church steps, her hem dragging through the same mud that coated his wheels. And she did not look at Vivian, and she did not look at the laughing guests, and she did not look away from him. When she reached him, he extended his hand, bare despite the cold, and said only, "You did not have to come down those steps for me." "No," she said, "I did not." Her voice surprised her with its steadiness. "But I find I would rather be laughed at for marrying a poor man of my own choosing than admired for marrying a rich one who did not want me." Something shifted behind his grey eyes, something that looked almost like surprise, almost like the first crack of light through a long-shut door. "Then we are agreed," he said quietly, "on more than the church will ever know." She placed her hand in his. His grip was warm despite the cold rain, steady despite the chaos of laughter still rolling through the churchyard, and for the first time in 3 humiliating weeks, Louisa Kensington felt something other than shame. She felt, absurdly, almost safe. Behind them, the laughter had not stopped. Someone was already composing the story they would tell at supper, embellishing the mud, the wretched horse, the dreadful carriage. None of them noticed that the man inside that carriage stood like he had never once in his life needed anyone's approval. None of them imagined that the muddy wheels belonged, in truth, to a fleet of vehicles fine enough to carry royalty, and that the man walking calmly into St. Aldwyn's Church that morning was Sebastian Alexander Ashcroft, Duke of Ravenscar, the richest duke in England. The doors of the church closed behind them, and the rain went on falling, and the laughter, for now, went on too. The wedding itself was a small, hurried thing, conducted by a tired vicar before a half-empty church, for most of the mocking guests had only come to watch the spectacle outside, and did not bother staying for vows that interested them far less than gossip did. Louisa barely remembered the words she spoke. She remembered the warmth of Sebastian's hand around hers, and the strange calm in his voice when he promised to honor her, as though he meant every syllable and had chosen them with care. Afterward, there was no grand wedding breakfast, no toasts from admiring friends. There was only the muddy carriage waiting outside, and a journey south toward a modest stone house that Sebastian called Thornfield Cottage. Though it was, Louisa thought privately, rather grander than a cottage had any right to be, with its high windows and well-kept gardens, even if it was nothing compared to the great estates of the nobility she had grown up admiring from a careful distance. She did not ask many questions on that first journey. She was too tired, too raw, too uncertain of what kind of man she had married. He did not press her to speak. He simply sat across from her in the carriage, watching the wet countryside pass, occasionally offering some small, dry observation about a passing farmhouse or a flooded lane that made the corner of her mouth twitch despite everything. "You are not what I expected," she admitted at last, somewhere past the third mile. "Few people expect much from a man who arrives in a carriage like mine," he said, and there was no bitterness in it, only a kind of weary amusement, as though the joke had grown old to him long before she ever heard it. "I did not mean the carriage." He looked at her then, properly, for the first time since the church steps. "What did you mean?" She considered her answer carefully. "I expected someone who needed a wife the way a man needs a roof over his head. Something practical. Necessary. I did not expect..." She paused, searching for the word. "Kindness." "Kindness costs nothing," he said simply, "and I have learned that very few people are willing to spend even that." Louisa thought of Vivian's bright, cruel laughter in the churchyard, of William's careless betrayal, of Lady Caroline's desperate calculations, and she understood, with a small ache, exactly what he meant. The weeks that followed at Thornfield settled into a rhythm neither of them had expected to find so easily. Sebastian rose early and disappeared for hours into what he called his study, a small room lined with books that Louisa found, on the rare occasions she peered inside, far too numerous and far too expensive looking for a man of modest means. He spoke, when he spoke at all of his work, of investments and correspondence, vague enough that she did not press, though the vagueness itself began to gather like a small stone in her mind. In the evenings, though, he was different, softer. He would sit near the fire while she read, asking her opinion on whatever novel she had chosen, listening with a genuine attention that no one, not even her own father in his more distracted years, had ever quite given her. One night, a storm rattled the windows of Thornfield with a fury that made the old house groan. Louisa had fallen asleep in her chair by the fire, the book sliding from her lap, exhaustion finally catching up to weeks of grief she had not allowed herself to feel. She woke, sometime later, to find a soft woolen blanket settled carefully over her shoulders, tucked in at the edges as though by someone who had taken real care over the task. Sebastian was seated across from her, a book open and forgotten in his hands, watching her with an expression so unguarded that her breath caught in her throat. For a moment, neither of them moved. The fire popped softly. The rain hammered the glass. His grey eyes held hers, and something passed between them that neither dared to name, warm and dangerous and entirely new. Then he looked away, clearing his throat, and the moment broke like a held breath, finally released. "Forgive me," he said. "You looked cold." "I am not cold," she said softly, and meant something larger than the blanket. He did not answer that, but he did not look away again either, not fully, and Louisa lay awake long after she retired to her own room, turning the memory of his gaze over and over, like a coin she could not stop touching. It was in the library, some days later, that the walls between them began, slowly, to come down further. Louisa had found a worn collection of poetry on a high shelf, and made the mistake of laughing aloud at a particularly dramatic verse about heartbreak. "You find tragedy amusing?" Sebastian asked from the doorway, one eyebrow raised. "I find this particular tragedy ridiculous," she said, holding up the book. "The poor man compares his beloved's eyes to drowning pools no fewer than 4 times in a single poem. I should think drowning only needs to happen once to make the point." He crossed the room and took the book from her hands, scanning the page, and to her delight, his mouth curved into the first real laugh she had heard from him, low and unguarded. "I had a tutor once who adored this very poet. I was made to recite this exact verse at the age of 12, in front of guests, while wearing a coat 3 sizes too large." "Now that," Louisa said, grinning, "is a tragedy I would gladly have watched." They spoke for hours that evening, trading small stories from childhoods that could not have been more different on the surface, and yet ached, she began to realize, with a similar loneliness underneath. He told her, carefully, edited in places she could feel but not yet name, of losing much of his family young, of years spent traveling under no name that mattered, searching for something he would not yet describe. She told him of growing up in Vivian's shadow, of a father who loved her quietly, but never loudly enough to be heard over her stepmother's ambitions. By the time the candles had burned low, Louisa realized, with a small jolt of alarm, that she had laughed more freely in that single evening than she had in the 3 years since her father's death. She realized, too, that she had stopped thinking, even once, of William Prescott's betrayal. She was beginning, dangerously, wonderfully, to fall for her own husband. And she had no idea yet how much of him remained hidden from her, waiting in the dark like a door she had not yet found the key to open. It began with small things, the kind of detail Louisa might once have let pass unnoticed had she not already begun watching her husband with the close attention of a woman falling in love against her own better judgment. A visiting solicitor, calling on some minor matter of the cottage's lease, addressed Sebastian in French regarding an old document, expecting, Louisa supposed, that a country gentleman of his standing would need the matter translated. Sebastian answered him fluently, without pause, in an accent so smooth it might have come from Paris itself, then returned just as easily to English as though nothing at all remarkable had occurred. Louisa said nothing in the moment, but that night, over a quiet supper, she set down her fork and studied her husband with new eyes. Where does a country gentleman learn French well enough to startle a solicitor into silence? Sebastian did not quite meet her gaze. I travelled once. Languages come easily when a man has nowhere else to spend his time. And politics? She pressed gently, for she had also noticed, on more than one evening, the easy authority with which he discussed matters of parliament, of trade agreements with India, of military strategy in conflicts most gentlewomen were never taught to follow at all. And foreign trade? And etiquette fine enough to make my own stepmother seem common by comparison? Curiosity is not a crime, Louisa. No, she agreed, but it is also not an explanation. He looked at her for a long moment, something unreadable moving behind his grey eyes, and she thought, for one breathless second, that he might finally tell her the truth. Instead, he reached across the table and covered her hand with his, and said only, "Give me time. I will tell you everything you wish to know. I only ask that you trust me a little longer." It was an unbearable thing to be asked for trust by a man who gave so little information to earn it. And yet she found, against all sense, that she did trust him, in the strange, helpless way a person trusts the warmth of a fire, even while wondering what fuel feeds it. The signet ring confirmed what she had already begun, quietly, to suspect. She found it by accident, tucked into the lining of an old travelling case she had been asked to pack for a brief journey to settle some matter of his correspondence. It was heavy gold, old enough that its edges had softened with age, engraved with a crest she did not recognize, a raven perched upon a crown of oak leaves, beneath words in Latin too worn to fully read. She was still turning it over in her palm when Sebastian entered the room and stopped dead in the doorway. "Where did you find that?" His voice was sharp in a way she had never heard from him before, urgent rather than angry. "In the case, I was not searching for anything, I promise you, I only..." He crossed the room in three strides and took the ring gently but firmly from her hand, closing his fist around it as though shielding it from the very air. "This belongs to a family matter I am not yet free to discuss," he said, and the careful steadiness had returned to his voice, but it could not quite undo the flash of alarm she had already seen. "Whose crest is that, Sebastian?" "One that does not concern Thornfield Cottage." He pocketed the ring and would not meet her eyes again that evening. Louisa lay awake long into the night, turning the crest over in her memory. A raven and a crown of oak. She did not know the families of the great noble houses well, her own modest standing having never required such study, but she knew enough to recognize that crests such as this one belonged to bloodlines far older and grander than any country gentleman's claim. Her suspicions deepened further still in London, where Sebastian was occasionally required to travel on what he called business, and where Louisa, accompanying him for the first time, began to notice a pattern too consistent to be coincidence. A bank clerk, upon seeing Sebastian enter, went pale and immediately summoned the institution's most senior partner, who arrived bowing so low Louisa nearly laughed aloud before catching the seriousness in the man's face. A footman at an inn where they stopped for the night refused payment entirely, insisting the matter was already settled, though Sebastian had made no such arrangement that Louisa had witnessed. Even strangers on the street, men of clear standing and consequence, would catch sight of him and incline their heads with a deference that made no sense at all for a gentleman of modest country means. "They look at you," Louisa said carefully, once they were alone in their rented rooms, "as though they are afraid of you, or in awe of you. I cannot decide which." "Perhaps," Sebastian said, not quite meeting her eyes, "they simply mistake me for someone else." "Three different cities, Sebastian. The same mistake made by dozens of strangers who have never met you before in their lives. I do not think that is mistaken identity. I think that is recognition." He set down the letter he had been reading and was quiet for a long moment, the fire crackling between them, his jaw tight with some internal struggle she could not name. When he finally spoke, his voice was lower than she had ever heard it. "I have not lied to you, Louisa. I have only delayed a truth I was not yet ready to give. There is a difference, though I understand if you cannot yet see it." "And when will you be ready?" "Soon," he said. "I promise you, soon. Only let me choose the moment." "There are people who would use the truth against us both if it came at the wrong time, in the wrong place." It was the word "us" that undid her resistance more than any explanation could have. Whatever he was hiding, he had spoken of it as something that endangered them together, not merely him alone. And Louisa found, with a small ache of helpless tenderness, that she would rather stand beside a mystery than retreat from one. But far away, in a townhouse far grander than Thornfield Cottage, a man named Archibald Sterling, Marquis, and cousin to the very secret Louisa was beginning to uncover, had just received word that the man he believed lost to obscurity 7 years ago had resurfaced, married, and very much alive. And Archibald Sterling, who had spent those same 7 years quietly arranging his own claim to a fortune he believed would never be reclaimed, did not receive that news with anything resembling calm. Archibald Sterling had built his entire future on an absence. 7 years before Louisa Kensington ever set foot in St. Aldwyn's Church, the man known to the world as Sebastian Alexander Ashcroft, Duke of Ravenscar, had vanished from society entirely, following the death of his parents and elder brother in a fever that swept through Ravenscar Court in a single terrible winter. He had been a young man then, barely past 20, suddenly the master of estates and fortunes vast enough to make him the wealthiest peer in England, and entirely without the family who might have helped him carry such weight. What followed had not been madness, though society had whispered that word freely enough in his absence. It had been something closer to grief and disgust. Every woman who sought his attention seemed to calculate, behind her smile, the value of Ravenscar Court. Every family who courted his friendship seemed to weigh, behind their warmth, the worth of his railways and his coal mines and his shipping interests. Sebastian had watched grief and greed tangle together in the eyes of nearly everyone who approached him, until he could no longer tell the difference between affection and appetite. So he had left. He had handed the daily management of his estates to a trusted steward, taken a modest income and a plain name, and disappeared into the unremarkable corners of England, searching, though he had not admitted this even fully to himself, for one person who might want the man rather than the title: Archibald, his cousin and nearest male relation, had managed the public fiction of Sebastian's absence with great patience, quietly positioning himself as the natural heir should the Duke never return, cultivating relationships with bankers and solicitors who handled the Ravenscar estates, building year by careful year a claim he fully intended to make permanent. The news that Sebastian had married openly, publicly, in a country churchyard before dozens of witnesses struck Archibald like a blow to the chest. "He has resurfaced," Archibald said to his solicitor, pacing the length of his study with barely controlled fury, "and married some penniless gentlewoman without a single thought for what this means for the arrangements I have spent 7 years building." "The marriage changes nothing legally, my lord," the solicitor offered carefully. "The Duke remains in full possession of his title and estates, regardless of his wife's standing." "It changes everything," Archibald snapped. "A wife is an heir waiting to be born. A wife is witnesses, allies, complications." "No, this will not stand. I want to know everything about this Louisa Kensington, and I want it within the week." Meanwhile, at Thornfield Cottage, Louisa knew nothing yet of the storm gathering against her, only that her husband had begun receiving correspondence sealed with wax stamps too fine for a country gentleman, and that his face, when he read them, grew increasingly shadowed with worry he would not yet explain. It was during this uneasy stretch that Vivian Kensington arrived unannounced at Thornfield, ostensibly to extend an olive branch to her estranged half-sister, though Louisa recognized the visit for what it truly was within the first 5 minutes. Vivian swept into the modest drawing-room in a gown far too fine for a country call, her eyes cataloguing the furnishings with poorly disguised curiosity, before settling, with sudden and complete attention, on Sebastian. "Your husband," Vivian said later, when she had managed a few private moments alone with him in the garden, ostensibly to admire the roses, "is far more interesting than the gossip suggested. I confess I expected someone considerably less formidable." "Formidable is not a word I would choose for myself," Sebastian replied evenly, though Louisa, watching from the window, could see the careful distance he kept, the way he angled his body subtly away from Vivian's, leaned toward him. "You are too modest." Vivian's smile was practiced, the same smile that had once charmed William Prescott, away from his own engagement, without a flicker of guilt. "Louisa has always been the quiet sort. I cannot imagine she challenges a man such as yourself, the way he might wish to be challenged." "You are mistaken," Sebastian said, his voice losing none of its courtesy, but gaining a note of finality that made even Vivian's confidence falter slightly. "Your sister challenges me more than any person I have known in years. It is, I have come to find, precisely what I value most in her." Vivian's smile thinned at the edges, though she recovered quickly enough, laughing it off as though the rejection had been a small joke between them, rather than the clear, unmistakable closing of a door. But Louisa, who had stepped quietly onto the garden path in time to hear the exchange, felt something warm and fierce kindle in her chest, a feeling she did not yet have a name for, though it sat very near to pride, and very near to love. When Vivian departed that evening, disappointed and visibly displeased, Louisa found Sebastian still standing among the roses, his expression thoughtful. "She came to test you," Louisa said quietly, coming to stand beside him. "I am aware." "And?" He turned to look at her then, and the late afternoon light caught the grey of his eyes in a way that made her breath catch. "I have spent years being tested by women who wanted my fortune before they wanted me, Louisa. I know the shape of that hunger very well. What I did not expect, what I have never once encountered before you, is a woman who looked at a poor man in a muddy carriage and chose him anyway. The distance between them had narrowed without either of them quite noticing, until his hand came up to brush a loose strand of hair from her cheek, his touch lingering longer than the small gesture required. "Sebastian," she whispered, and his name felt different in her mouth now, weighted with something she had not let herself feel since William's betrayal taught her the cost of wanting anyone too much. "I know I have not told you everything," he said, his voice rough at the edges. "But I want you to know that whatever I have kept from you was never meant to wound you. It was only ever meant to protect what we have built here, until I was certain it could not be taken from us."
"And can it be taken from us now?" she asked, suddenly afraid, though she could not have said of what.
His jaw tightened, the shadow of worry returning to his eyes. "There is a man," he admitted at last, "who would very much like to see this marriage, and everything attached to it, undone. I did not expect him to move so quickly. I will need to go to London soon to settle matters before he can do real harm."
"Then I will come with you, Louisa."
"I did not choose dignity over approval in that churchyard, Sebastian, only to be left behind now that danger has a name." She held his gaze, steady, unflinching, the same quiet courage that had carried her down the church steps months before. "Whatever you are facing, you will not face it alone. Not anymore." Something in his expression broke open then, something he had perhaps guarded even more carefully than his title, and he pulled her gently into his arms, pressing his lips to her forehead with a tenderness that made her knees go weak.
"Then we go together," he murmured against her hair,
"and may every man who underestimated us both learn what that costs him." Far away in London, Archibald Sterling was already drafting the first of his lies. London received Sebastian and Louisa with a strange, watchful hush that Louisa could not quite interpret in her first days there. Servants at the townhouse Sebastian kept, far grander than Thornfield, though he had never once mentioned its existence, moved with a deference that bordered on reverence. Bankers who called upon the house addressed Sebastian with a formality that made Louisa's skin prickle with unspoken questions she had promised herself she would not yet ask, trusting that he would tell her in his own time, as he had promised. It was Archibald who broke the careful quiet first, and not with honesty. A rumor began circulating through London's drawing rooms within days of their arrival, whispered first at a card party, then repeated at a dinner, then printed, in carefully vague terms, in a gossip column that Lady Caroline Kensington happened to read aloud.
At her own breakfast table, with poorly concealed delight, the rumor suggested that Louisa Kensington's mysterious new husband was not merely poor, but possibly a fraud entirely, a man trading on a stolen name and forged connections to extract money from a desperate, scandal-ridden bride.
Louisa read the column herself with shaking hands.
"They are calling you a confidence trickster," she said, when Sebastian found her in the townhouse library, the offending paper crumpled in her fist. "They are saying I married a criminal out of desperation."
"It is a lie," Sebastian said calmly, though a muscle worked tight in his jaw. "And lies of this particular shape have only one author I can think of. Archibald." "He has moved faster than I anticipated. I underestimated how much he stands to lose now that I have returned." Sebastian took the paper from her hands and set it aside, his expression grim.
"He will not stop at rumor, Louisa. A man defending 7 years of careful theft will use whatever weapon comes easiest. I should have told you everything before we ever left Thornfield."
"I am sorry for that."
"Then tell me now," she said, and there was no anger in her voice, only a plea, raw and honest. "Whatever it is, Sebastian, tell me now, before strangers in newspapers tell me a version that is not even true." He was quiet for a long moment, and then, finally, he reached into his coat and withdrew the heavy gold signet ring she had found weeks before, the raven and the crown of oak gleaming in the lamplight. "This is the seal of the House of Ashcroft," he said quietly. "My house. I am Sebastian Alexander Ashcroft, Duke of Ravenscar. I own Ravenscar Court, and Highmere Hall, and Silver Oak Hall. I hold shares in railway companies, shipping interests across three oceans, and coal mines enough to keep half of Yorkshire employed. I am, Louisa, by most measures society uses to judge such things, the richest duke in England." Louisa stared at him, the words settling slowly, impossibly, into place. The carriage, the strange deference of strangers, the languages, the politics, the easy authority that had never quite fit a country gentleman's modest claim. "You let them laugh at you," she whispered, "at the church. You let the entire churchyard mock a carriage you could have replaced 100 times over, and you said nothing. I have spent 7 years being chased by people who wanted my title and never the man beneath it," Sebastian said, his voice low and rough with old, careful pain. "I built that carriage's reputation deliberately, Louisa. I travelled under a plain name, in plain conveyances, specifically so that I might one day find a woman who would choose me when I appeared to have nothing at all to offer her. You did that. In front of everyone who had ever laughed at you, you chose the poor man in the mud, and you did not know, could not have known, that you were also choosing the richest duke in England." Tears stood in Louisa's eyes, equal parts overwhelmed and undone. "You built an entire deception around finding someone who would not deceive you." "I built it around finding someone honest," he corrected gently, taking her hand. "I never once expected to find someone I would fall so completely in love with in the process. The word love, spoken so plainly, so unguarded, between them for the first time, seemed to still the very air of the room." Louisa's breath caught, her heart hammering, loud enough she was certain he must hear it. "Sebastian," she breathed. "I crossed half of England searching for someone who could see me," he said, drawing her closer, his hand warm against the curve of her jaw. "And then I found you, laughing at poetry in a library, choosing dignity over a crowd's approval, asking nothing of me but honesty. I do not think I have ever wanted anything in my life the way I want you, Louisa. Title or no title, mud or marble, it has always only been you." She closed the distance between them herself this time, her hand fisting gently in his coat. And when his mouth finally found hers, it was not the careful, cautious touch of strangers learning each other's edges. It was hunger, restrained too long, finally given permission to ache, slow and deep and trembling with all the longing neither of them had dared name through weeks of fireside evenings and library confessions. His arms came around her, pulling her flush against him, and she felt, beneath the fine fabric of his coat, the unmistakable thunder of his own heart matching hers beat for frantic beat. When they finally parted, breathless, foreheads pressed together, neither of them moved to step away. "Whatever Archibald throws at us," Louisa murmured against his lips, "we throw it back twice as hard." "That," Sebastian said, the ghost of a smile finally returning to his face, "is precisely the wife I hoped I had found." Their reckoning came 2 days later, in the form of a sealed letter bearing the royal crest, personally addressed to His Grace the Duke of Ravenscar, inviting him, by name and title at last fully restored to public record, to attend Her Majesty's charity ball at week's end. Archibald Stirling, when news of the royal summons reached him through his own network of informants, understood with cold, sinking certainty that his window for quiet sabotage had nearly closed. If Sebastian appeared at that ball, publicly acknowledged before all of London society, every rumor Archibald had spent weeks carefully seeding would collapse overnight, and every plan he had built across 7 patient years would collapse along with it. He would need, he decided grimly, one final and far more drastic move before that ballroom door ever opened. The night before the royal summons arrived, London had been drenched in a steady, soft rain, the kind that turned gas lamps into smudges of gold along the wet pavement. Sebastian and Louisa had gone walking despite it, sharing a single black umbrella too small to keep either of them fully dry, their shoulders pressed close along a narrow lane near Ravenscar House, simply because there was no room to walk otherwise. Neither of them had spoken for several minutes, content in a silence that had grown over the past weeks, increasingly comfortable rather than careful. Louisa felt the warmth of him along her side, the occasional brush of his hand against hers as the umbrella tilted with the wind, and found that she no longer flinched away from the small, accidental intimacies that had once made her breath catch with uncertainty. "You are quiet tonight," Sebastian said eventually, his voice low, almost lost beneath the patter of rain. "I am thinking," Louisa admitted, "of how strange it is to feel safer in the rain with you than I ever felt at any ball, in any fine gown, surrounded by every comfort money could provide." He stopped walking, turning to face her fully beneath the small shelter of the umbrella, rain misting at its edges. "Comfort and safety are not always the same thing," he said quietly. "I learned that lesson rather thoroughly, in rooms full of silk and jewels where I never once felt safe at all. And now?" "Now," he said, reaching up to brush a raindrop from her cheek with a gentleness that made her entire body still. "I feel safer standing in a narrow, wet lane with you than I have felt anywhere in 7 long years." The space between them had narrowed to almost nothing, his hand lingering against her jaw, and when he finally lowered his head to kiss her, slow and unhurried, despite the rain soaking steadily into both their coats, Louisa felt the last of her old caution dissolve entirely. She rose onto her toes, her hands fisting in the lapels of his coat, drawing him closer, deepening a kiss that had begun gently and grown, gradually, into something far more searching, far more certain. When they finally parted, breathless, the umbrella forgotten, and tilted uselessly to one side, neither of them moved to step back from the rain. "We are going to be thoroughly soaked," Louisa murmured against his lips, laughing softly. "Then let us be soaked together," Sebastian said, and kissed her again. The ballroom of Wexford House blazed with candlelight the evening of the royal charity ball, chandeliers throwing gold across a sea of silk and jewels, and every notable family in London society gathered beneath them, eager for an evening of spectacle. Louisa stood at the edge of the receiving line in a gown of deep sapphire blue, commissioned hastily but beautifully in the days since Sebastian's confession, and felt, for the first time in longer than she could remember, entirely certain of who stood beside her. William Prescott was there, with Vivian on his arm, both of them dressed in the height of fashion, both of them entirely unaware of what the evening held in store. Lady Caroline Kensington hovered nearby, still uncertain how to behave around a stepdaughter whose fortunes had recently become far less predictable than she had assumed. And near the refreshment tables, watching the room with the sharp, calculating eyes of a man whose carefully built world was about to collapse, stood Archibald Stirling, Marquess, cousin to the Duke of Ravenscar, and architect of every lie that had chased Sebastian and Louisa across London for the past fortnight. the master of ceremonies, a stout man with a voice trained to carry across the largest of rooms, rapped his staff against the floor as the orchestra fell silent, and the crowd's chatter quieted in expectant waves. "His Grace," the master of ceremonies announced, his voice ringing clear across the gathered hundreds. "Sebastian Alexander Ashcroft, Duke of Ravenscar." The room did not merely quiet. It froze entirely, as though every guest had been struck still mid-breath. Heads turned, glasses paused halfway to lips. Louisa felt every eye in the ballroom swing toward her husband as he stepped forward at her side, dressed now not in the plain, modest clothes of a country gentleman, but in a fine dark coat that fit him as though tailored that very morning, his bearing radiating an authority the room could no longer mistake for anything but exactly what it was. She watched the recognition spread across the crowd like fire catching dry grass. She watched the very same noblewomen who had whispered cruelly outside St. Aldwyn's Church go pale, their fans freezing mid-flutter. She watched gentlemen who had laughed loudest at the muddy carriage suddenly straighten their collars and search the crowd, desperate to remember whether they had been overheard mocking him months before. She watched Vivian's triumphant smile crack and crumble into something close to panic as the full weight of what she had lost settled over her at last. And she watched William Prescott's face drain of all color as he understood, in one terrible instant, precisely the magnitude of the woman and the fortune he had so carelessly cast aside. Archibald Sterling did not move at all. He stood frozen near the refreshment tables, his face a mask of barely controlled fury, watching 7 years of patient theft collapse in the space of a single announcement. Sebastian did not look at any of them. He looked only at Louisa, offering his arm with the same quiet steadiness he had offered his hand outside the muddy carriage months before. "Shall we, Your Grace?" he said softly, and Louisa realized with a small jolt that the title now belonged equally to her. "We shall," she said, and took his arm and walked into the heart of the ballroom beside him as though she had been born to it. What followed was, by any measure, a triumph. Hosts who had never once invited Louisa to so much as a modest tea now fell over themselves seeking introduction. Mothers who had warned their sons away from the scandal of her broken engagement now angled their daughters hopefully toward conversation with the new Duchess of Ravenscar. It would have been easy, Louisa thought, watching this sudden reversal unfold, to drink deeply of the satisfaction such a turn afforded her. But she found, to her own surprise, that the approval of this glittering, fickle crowd meant far less to her now than it ever had, because she had already found, in a muddy churchyard with no one watching, the one thing their approval could never give her. It was Archibald who forced the second confrontation of the evening, cornering Sebastian near the terrace doors once the worst of the crowd's shock had settled into a low, excited buzz. "You have ruined 7 years of careful work," Archibald said, in a low, venomous voice, all pretense of cousinly affection abandoned now that the room's eyes were no longer upon him. "I built a life on the assumption you would never return to claim it." "You built a life on theft, Archibald," Sebastian replied evenly, "and dressed it in patience to make it look like virtue. That is finished now." "Is it?" Archibald's smile was thin and dangerous. "I would not be so certain, cousin. There are ledgers, documents, years of small adjustments that have left certain accounts considerably harder to untangle than you might imagine. Reclaiming your title does not undo the damage already done to your estates." "Then we shall untangle them together," Sebastian said calmly, "before a magistrate, if that is what you prefer. I have already begun gathering precisely the documents you mention. My solicitors have been quietly at work for several days now, Archibald. You might have noticed, had you spent less time spreading rumors about my wife and more time covering your own tracks. Archibald's confident sneer faltered for the first time, a flicker of real fear crossing his face before he could smooth it away. Later that night, when the worst of the public spectacle had finally settled and the newly acknowledged Duke and Duchess of Ravenscar found a rare, quiet moment together near the terrace, Louisa finally asked the question that had been sitting heavy in her chest since the ballroom doors first opened. "Why me, Sebastian?" she asked softly. "Of everyone you might have chosen when you finally decided to stop hiding, why a woman the rest of society had already discarded?" He turned to face her fully, the moonlight silvering the sharp lines of his face, and there was nothing guarded left in his expression at all. "Because you were discarded by people who never deserved to hold you in the first place, and you survived it with more grace than I have seen from anyone who has never known a single day of true want. Because when the whole world laughed at me, you were the only one who looked past the mud to the man standing in it. I did not choose you because you had nothing left to lose, Louisa. I chose you because you had everything that mattered, and the rest of the world was simply too foolish to see it." She kissed him then, slow and aching and certain, the cool night air wrapping around them both as the music drifted faintly from the ballroom beyond, and for the first time since this entire impossible story began outside a rain-soaked church. Louisa Kensington, now Duchess of Ravenscar, allowed herself to believe completely in the love she had found. But Archibald Stirling, watching from the shadows of the terrace doors, had not yet finished fighting for the fortune he believed should have been his. The weeks following the Royal Charity Ball moved with the strange dual rhythm of public triumph and private danger. By day, Louisa found herself swept into a society that had once shut its doors against her, now suddenly eager to claim her friendship, her favor, her invitation list. She accepted this reversal with a wary grace, neither cruel in her new power nor foolish enough to trust it completely, for she had learned, at great personal cost, exactly how quickly such favor could turn. By night, in the quiet of Ravenscar House, she and Sebastian pored over ledgers and letters that Sebastian's solicitors had gathered, piece by careful piece, documenting 7 years of Archibald Stirling's quiet theft, falsified accounts, diverted rent from tenant farms that should have gone toward repairs, and instead vanished into Archibald's own holdings, forged signatures on documents meant to slowly, legally, transfer control of smaller Ravenscar properties into Archibald's own name, banking entirely on the assumption that Sebastian would never return to notice. "He was patient," Sebastian said one evening, studying a particularly damning ledger by candlelight. "But patience is not the same as cleverness. He left a trail any competent solicitor could follow, provided that solicitor had reason to look." "And now he has reason to fear discovery," Louisa said, leaning over his shoulder to study the figures herself. She had, in the months since their marriage, developed a keen eye for numbers that often startled the solicitors Sebastian employed, men who had not expected a duchess to follow their reasoning so precisely. "What will you do with him, once the evidence is complete?" "What the law allows," Sebastian said simply. "No more, no less. I will not become the kind of man who destroys his enemies through cruelty rather than justice. That has never been the kind of duke I wish to be." It was, perhaps, this very restraint that proved Sebastian's undoing in the short term. For Archibald, sensing the noose tightening around his careful theft, made one final desperate attempt to salvage his position before the evidence could be formally presented. He arrived at Ravenscar House unannounced one grey afternoon, demanding audience with Sebastian alone, and when Louisa, sensing trouble, insisted on remaining present despite her husband's quiet attempt to spare her the unpleasantness, Archibald did not bother hiding his contempt any longer. "You will destroy me over a matter of inheritance technicalities," Archibald said, pacing the length of the study with barely restrained agitation. "When you yourself abandoned this title for 7 years, tell me, cousin, what makes your absence so different from my management in it?" "I never claimed what was not mine," Sebastian said evenly. "You forged signatures, Archibald. You diverted funds meant for tenant families who depend on those repairs for their very roofs. That is not management. That is theft, plain and simple, and dressing it in 7 years of patience does not change its nature." "And what would you have had me do?" Archibald's voice rose, the careful composure he had maintained for years finally cracking entirely. "Watch everything you abandoned crumble to ruin while you played at being a poor man in the countryside, searching for some woman foolish enough to love you without knowing your worth? I built, I managed, I held this family together while you indulged your grief in obscurity." "You held nothing together," Louisa said quietly, stepping forward before Sebastian could answer, her voice steady despite the tension crackling through the room. "You built a fortune on the assumption that a grieving man would never return to claim what was rightfully his. That is not loyalty to family, my lord. That is opportunism, and you have simply run out of time to disguise it as anything finer." Archibald turned his fury toward her instead, his face twisted with the particular venom of a man who has been seen too clearly. "You, a penniless gentlewoman who married a stranger out of desperation, now lecturing me on family loyalty? You know nothing of what this family required to survive, Duchess." "I know enough," Louisa replied, unflinching, "to recognize a man who mistakes greed for virtue simply because no one stopped him soon enough to tell him otherwise. Someone has stopped you now." The confrontation ended not in violence, but in something far more devastating for a man of Archibald's pride: complete, documented exposure. Within the week, Sebastian's solicitors presented the full evidence of Archibald's forgeries and diverted funds before the appropriate magistrates, and the scandal that followed swallowed Archibald's reputation as thoroughly as Louisa's own had once been swallowed outside St. Aldwyn's Church, though with considerably less sympathy extended by London society this time around. Archibald Stirling was stripped of his access to the Ravenscar estates entirely, forced to make restitution to the tenant families whose repairs he had so callously delayed, and found himself, almost overnight, the subject of exactly the kind of whispered scorn he had once tried so hard to direct at others. He left London not long after, his name no longer welcome at the tables where he had once dined so comfortably, and Louisa felt, watching his quiet departure from a distance, not triumph exactly, but a settled, quiet sense that justice, slow as it had been, had finally arrived where it belonged. William Prescott and Vivian Kensington fared little better in the months that followed, though their punishment came not from any deliberate cruelty on Sebastian and Louisa's part, but simply from the natural consequence of a society that had always valued proximity to power above any genuine loyalty. Invitations that had once flowed freely toward Vivian now diminished steadily, as hostesses who once courted her favor quietly redirected their attention toward the new Duchess of Ravenscar instead. Vivian wrote, eventually, a careful letter to Louisa, full of half-apologies dressed as pleasantries, hinting hopefully at renewed closeness now that circumstances had shifted so dramatically. Louisa read it once, considered it carefully, and replied with polite, distant civility that offered warmth without ever again offering trust. Some doors, she had learned, were not meant to be reopened, simply because the weather outside them had changed. The final climax of their long, improbable story arrived, fittingly, not in a grand ballroom or a courtroom, but in the muddy courtyard of Ravenscar Court itself, many months after that first humiliating morning outside St. Aldwyn's Church. Louisa stood on the great stone steps of the estate, now fully settled into her role as its mistress, watching as an old, familiar carriage rattled up the drive. The same warped wood, the same peeling paint, the same caked ancient mud upon its wheels, kept entirely unrepaired, despite the dozens of finer carriages now available to them both. "You truly mean to keep it," she said, laughing, as Sebastian climbed.
Down from the very vehicle that had once been the subject of an entire churchyard's mockery. "Of course I mean to keep it." He crossed the courtyard to take her hands in his grey eyes warm with the particular fondness he reserved only for her. "That carriage carried me to you, Louisa, through mud and rain and the laughter of people who understood nothing at all about what mattered. I will not discard the very thing that brought me my greatest fortune, simply because it never looked the part. It is rather an odd ornament for a duke's courtyard," she teased. "Then let it be odd," he said, drawing her close, "and let everyone who once laughed at it understand, every time they pass through these gates, exactly what kind of richness that mud once carried, and exactly what kind of woman was brave enough to climb into it." That evening, beneath the great chandeliers of Ravenscar Court's ballroom, with no audience but the household staff and a few close friends who had earned their place through genuine loyalty rather than fashionable proximity, Sebastian and Louisa danced together as the music swelled and faded into something softer, something private, something entirely their own. The world that had once mocked them both in different ways, on different days, for different cruelties, had fallen away entirely, leaving only the quiet certainty of two people who had found, against every improbable odd, exactly the love they had each spent years searching for. "They laughed when you arrived in that muddy carriage," Louisa murmured against his chest, her eyes closed, the music carrying them in slow, easy circles across the polished floor. "I wonder if any of them ever imagined where it would lead." "Let them wonder," Sebastian said softly, pressing a kiss to her hair. "We already know the answer, my love. And it was always only you." In the years that followed, the story of the muddy carriage outside St. Aldwyn's Church became something of a quiet legend among the tenant families and household staff of Ravenscar Court, passed along in the kind of fond, embellished retelling that only truly happy stories ever earn. Children who grew up on the estate's grounds were told, by nursemaids and grandparents alike, of the poor gentleman who arrived through the rain to marry a humiliated bride, and of how the very carriage everyone mocked that morning turned out to belong to the richest duke in all of England. Louisa, in her quieter moments, often thought back to the woman she had been on that grey, miserable morning, standing alone in a church doorway, certain that her life had already reached its lowest, most permanent point. She had not known, could not have known, that humiliation and fortune sometimes arrive wearing the very same muddy coat, and that the only thing required to tell them apart was the courage to look past the mud entirely toward the man standing within it. Sebastian, for his part, never did replace that carriage, not in all the years that followed, though Ravenscar Court stables grew to house some of the finest vehicles in England for the family's actual use. The old, warped, mud-stained carriage remained exactly where he had first kept it,
a quiet monument to the 7 lonely years he had spent searching for someone honest enough to be worth revealing himself to, and to the single grey, rainy morning when he had finally, against every careful calculation he had made about the world, found her. Vivian Kensington eventually married a baronet of modest fortune and smaller ambitions than she had once dreamed of, settling into a life considerably quieter than the one she had imagined for herself in younger, crueler days. William Prescott's career in society never fully recovered from the scandal of his own careless betrayal, a fitting, unforced consequence of a choice he had made, without ever once considering its lasting cost. And Archibald Sterling, stripped of both fortune and reputation, lived out his remaining years in a modest house far removed from the grand estates he had once schemed so patiently to claim, a permanent reminder that patience spent in service of theft is patience wasted entirely. As for Louisa and Sebastian, their love only deepened with each passing year, weathering the ordinary trials that come to every marriage, fortified always by the singular truth at its foundation, that they had found each other not through fortune or title or careful calculation, but through honesty alone, offered freely by two people who had each, in their own way, been laughed at and underestimated by a world too distracted by appearances to see what truly mattered standing in front of it. They laughed when her groom arrived in a muddy carriage that grey morning outside St. Aldwyn's Church. They did not know he was the richest duke in England. But more than that, dear viewers, they did not know that the woman standing beside him, the same woman they had so recently scorned and discarded, possessed a richness of her own, a courage and honesty worth more than every title and fortune in that churchyard combined. And it was, in the end, exactly that richness, hers and his together, that built a love no scandal, no schemer, and no muddy road could ever wash away. And there, dear viewers, we leave our Duke and Duchess of Ravenscar, dancing beneath their own chandeliers, the world they once feared finally quiet around them. Thank you so much for staying with us until the very end of this tale. If this story of mud, mockery, and unlikely love moved you even a little, we would be ever so grateful if you would leave a like, share it with someone who loves a good Victorian romance, and subscribe so you never miss the next tale from Old England. Do tell us in the comments where in the world you are watching from, and what time it is for you as this story closes. Your support means more to this small channel than we can ever fully express. Until our next story together, take care, and thank you, truly, from all of us, for staying till the end.